And tonight, we'd like to invite your attention to 1 Peter chapter 5. I suppose it goes without saying that we are nearing the end of this book. I have been debating what I'm going to do when I get to the end, whether I'll go on into 2 Peter, or maybe go back and pursue maybe one of the Old Testament books or something like that. I just really haven't come to any definite decision yet. You'll have to pray that the Lord will guide me in what he wants me to do. I suppose you could say our entire lesson tonight in verse 8 and 9 would have to do with the fact that we are to watch out for the devil. Be on guard against the devil might be another way to express it. There are a lot of people that do not believe in the existence of a personal devil. One of the articles of faith that we have here in our confession states that we believe in a personal devil. And if I didn't have the Bible to prove to me there was a devil, I'd know that there was one. Because of the many encounters that I've had with him, seems like any time that I go to do anything that I feel is right, he's always there to create problems and resist the work that I try to do. So we might say that Peter tonight is dealing with the topic of watch out for the devil in verse 8 and 9. In the 8th verse, he tells us about Satan's character, names, and work. And really, there's quite a revelation given here of the devil in that 8th verse. Let's read it now. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. And let me just make this one brief comment before I elaborate on that verse. The idea is propagated by the amillennialists that the devil is now bound to the child of God. It would seem to me that they'd have a hard time convincing Simon Peter of that in view of the fact of what he said there in that 8th verse. Why would we need to watch out for the devil if indeed he's bound to the child of God and can't do anything at all against us? I'd like to ask one other question. Who is it gives us all this trouble then if he's bound to us? Who's that fellow? Well, there are two commands in the first part of the verse. Be sober, be vigilant. Two B's there. Incidentally, sometime read the Bible and keep up with the B's of the Bible. Be sober, be vigilant, and things like that. You'll be astonished at how many B's there are like that in the Bible. Must be born again. You must be converted. All kind of B's there that you can think about. Now, the expression there, be sober. Normally, when we hear about somebody practicing sobriety today, we seem to have the idea that he engages in total abstinence from all alcoholic drinks and beverages. Well, that certainly would be a part of sobriety if you wanted to look at it from that standpoint. But that's really not what Peter has in mind when he uses that term. And this is the third time that he said be sober. Back in chapter 1, verse 13, he talked about being sober. Chapter 4 and verse 7. He reaffirmed the same thing, and now he said it for a third time. Looking at the context, especially back there in the verses where he's used it before, he means to be sober-minded. And especially we need to be sober-minded if we're going to be on guard against the devil. The devil has many devices and schemes. He has many fiery darts. There are many wiles of the devil. And because of that, we need to be sober-minded. So I would take the statement here, be sober, to say don't let the devil make a playhouse out of your mind. If there is anything that the devil is out to get, it is our mind. He wants to get our mind. More than anything else, he wants to get into the mind of man. That's the battleground. Now, what did he get into in the Garden of Eden when he attacked Eve? He persuaded her in her mind that she ought to eat of that forbidden fruit. So we need to be sober-minded and not allow the devil to use our mind for a playground. And incidentally, we ought not to let him use it as a battleground either, I think, sometime, if we can prevent it, because he likes to do that too. Now, maybe another way we could express this thought of sobriety is that we ought to be self-restrained, or maybe some would say self-contained. That's maybe another way to express it. But the idea is that the outward man and the inward man is to be governed by the rules of temperance, modesty and mortification. Now somebody said, how does this verse fit in with what's gone before? He said, don't be careful about anything. And then he said, watch out for the devil. Looked like he contradicted himself. No. God provides for his people. Therefore, don't be overly anxious about how it's going to be with you in this world. The devil is out to seek and destroy us. Therefore, watch out and be on guard. There's nothing incompatible with those two statements. Now, there is one thing for sure. The way that Peter follows this eighth verse with what he said in verse 7, he in no way in verse 7 intended to convey the thought of some sort of carnal security. Because there is only security in God, especially against the evil one. So be sober-minded. Then he said, be vigilant. There was a saying in the early history of this country that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. I can't remember whether Thomas Jefferson said that or some of the other men, founding fathers of this country. I believe it was Thomas Jefferson, if my mind serves me correctly. But anyway, it's a great saying, and many other people have uttered the saying since that time. And so the way to watch out for the devil is to always be vigilant. And that's just another way of saying the price of Christian liberty from the devil is eternal vigilance. So I'll coin a new expression there about that. The funny thing about this word vigilant that's used here, everywhere else that the same Greek word occurs, like in Matthew 24, 42 and 43, Matthew 25 and 13, Matthew 26, 38, Matthew 26 there, verse 40 and 41, everywhere else that it occurs, it's translated watch. You know, Christ said, watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. And talked about if you knew in what watch the thief would come, you'd watch and not have your house broken up. It's the same word there in the original. So we're not to be so secure and careless that we somehow would be unaware of our danger from the enemy. There is nobody in any greater danger than the one that believes that he's secure. And really, in a man's feeling of security, in the spiritual realm, there is a great deal of insecurity. That's why the Bible says, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. And one of the greatest dangers in the world is self-confidence. And the man that wrote this book knew a great deal about that. You may remember that he said, Lord, though all men forsake you, I won't. But he did. Said, though all men deny you, I never will. But he did. So what was wrong with Peter? He wasn't practicing what he said here. He wasn't being sober, and he wasn't being vigilant. So here's a man not only writing by inspiration of God, but he's also writing by his own personal experience. No one knew better than Simon Peter that when it came to this matter of the devil, that a man needed to be sober-minded and be on guard because he'd failed to do it in his early days. Right now, tonight, many of our troops in the Persian Gulf are in what we'd call enemy territory. Now, I know that they're trying to take Kuwait back, and I hope that they do it very speedily. But there are at least a portion of our troops over in Iraq going up to the north there to take on the Republican Guard. But the thing about it is, those troops are in enemy territory. They may run across a landmine. They may suddenly have a tank come rising up out of the dust and start firing bullets at them. They may have all kinds of things to happen in a way of camouflage out in the desert. All at once, it'll strike them. And I assure you that every one of those that are there tonight realize that they are in enemy territory. And I'll tell you two things they're doing. They're being sober and they're being watchful. And you know, in a sense, we are in enemy territory. This world has the devil as its prince. He's the prince of this world. Christ said so. Not only is the prince of this world, but he's also the god of this world. The Apostle Paul tells us that. So we're not in a place of peace and safety. We're in enemy territory. And there may be all kinds of little surprises out there that the devil has for us. He'll try to catch us off guard. He'll try to come at us with minor skirmishes and then wage a great war. So we had better be on the watch out, because we're in enemy territory. You remember there in the parable of the wheat and the tares, and we sang about it here a minute ago, that great song by Henry Alford. But anyway, in that song it talks about the wheat and the tares. But if you remember the parable there in Matthew 13, it talks about the devil, you know, sowing the tares among the wheat. But the remarkable thing is, in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 39, he's called the enemy. The enemy that did it was the devil. Now, a lot of times when we think about the devil, we say he's the enemy of God. That's true. But don't forget, like we're told in Matthew 13, he's the enemy of man. And so if he's just the enemy of God, we'd let God watch out for him, you see. And God could take care of him. But he is our enemy. And we are in enemy territory. We must be on guard. We must be on the watch out. And so we must be free from care so far as being overly anxious about the events of this world. But at the same time, we must be watchful for the evil work of the devil that's out there to ensnare us and fire darts that he'll hurl against us from time to time. Then he goes on to talk about, he gives two titles of the devil here. He said, because your adversary. You know, that's a rather peculiar word. I spent a lot of time studying that word. It intrigued me. I'd studied it out before, but I never had noticed something. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount there in Matthew 25, rather it's chapter 5 and verse 25, when Christ said, agree with your adversary in the way. It's the same Greek word that we have here that's adversary. And it's a peculiar word. Looking at the meaning of it in A.T. Robinson's word pictures in the New Testament, I found out that it meant, it was a very old word, he said, in the Greek for an opponent in a lawsuit. That's an adversary. An opponent in a lawsuit. John Gill called it a law adversary. And so it has the idea of a courtroom scene. And a public defender like it, a prosecuting attorney, and the law being quoted this way and that way, and pleas being made on the part of two parties and the like. And we'll say more about that later. But just remember that the word adversary means a law adversary, or somebody that is your opponent in a lawsuit. And I'll say more about it in a few moments. Now let's think about that for a little bit. The devil is a rather strange fellow when you think about it. He goes out there and he tempts a man to sin. And then he runs up to God and said, now look here what he done. You'll have to punish him now. See what he's done? To me, that's the thought that I see there in the mind of Peter. So Satan will lead a man into sin, and then he'll go up to God and he'll say, this man has made a breach in the law, and you ought to be just and you ought to punish him for these sins that he's committed. Why don't you kill him? Why don't you cut him down in his tracks if you're the just God you claim to be? So you see, the devil, he tries to use the law of God to bring accusations against the saints. So no wonder over here in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 10, he's called the accuser of the brethren. What does he accuse us of? Our sins. And what does he plead that ought to be a means of causing us to be punished? The law of God. He said not to do that, and he done it. Now you get him. That's more or less what he does. He's our adversary in the lawsuit. Here in Revelation 12 and 10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down. What does he do? Which accuse them before our God day and night. So I repeat again, what the devil does, he goes out and he leads a man to commit a sin, and then he goes to God and he quotes his own law to him and says, now punish him. You're a just God. Look what he's done. You'll have to deal with him. There's a lot of scenes go on like that up there in heaven. that we don't think about sometime. Another time that you can see the devil, as it were, in the court, pleading against God's people is like in the book of Zechariah, chapter 13 and verse 1. And he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand. And incidentally, the word Satan, now you have to remember, means adversary. And Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. So the devil pleads the law of God and tells God to punish us for our sins, even though he tempted us to do it. And there's another scene that takes place in heaven. God the Father points to the lamb that was slain and says there was the payment for their sins. And the devil cannot lay anything then to the charge of one of God's elect, because it's God that justifies on the basis of the atoning blood of Jesus Christ. But you know, just the thought there that the devil is our adversary. He's our enemy, like. He's a fellow that opposes us. Any time that a child of God goes out to do good, he'll be opposed by the devil. And you can take even a lost sinner or a backslider. If they're thinking about repenting and going back to God, the devil will insist that they not do it. And if a man begins to consider his salvation, consider the word that has been sown in his heart by the one that sows the gospel seeds, the devil will come and take away the word that's been sown in the heart, lest the man hear that word and believe it and be saved. So he's out to oppose man. So he not only calls him here your adversary, but he says also that he's the devil. That is the Greek word diabolos. The word devil means accuser or slander. And so, like I said, he leads people to sin, and then like a lawyer, he accuses them before God. Incidentally, the word Satan is of Hebrew origin, and the word devil is of Greek origin. And of course, the word devil means accuser and slander, and the word Satan means adversary. It means adversary. He goes on then to describe the devil, and it doesn't sound like that he's a real nice fellow in the description that follows. As a roaring lion. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion. Now, what do you think of most of the time when you would think about a lion? I think about strength, violence, and the fact that he's always out trying to catch a prey somewhere. He's a man eater. He's a flesh eater. And so Peter certainly doesn't believe the devil's bound to the child of God. He says he's going around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he's going to eat as a prey. I don't know how you could reconcile that with him being bound to the child of God. It'd be most difficult in my estimation. So I would say that the terminology there of lion expresses his fierceness and strength. I'm still having trouble with this cold and cannot get my word enunciation out tonight. But the thought is there of fierceness and strength. You know, naturalists tell us that when a lion is hungry, he'll roar just before he eats the prey. We don't only have the naturalists to tell us that. We can just take the Bible, and the Bible tells the same thing that the naturalists do. Let me show you. Look over here in Psalms 104 at verse 21. You'll find that the Bible is up to date, as always. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their meat from God. So the Bible is right in line with what the naturalists tell us. And so if the devil is pictured here as a roaring lion, it means that he's hungry and ready to eat a fellow up on the spot. You know, it's one thing to find a lion out in the woods. It's another thing to find one that's hungry. Most time, he's going to satisfy his hunger. And so the devil's not pictured here as an old lazy lion laying up in his lair somewhere. But he's pictured here as a lion that's running around, that's hungry, ready to devour and eat people up. That's what he's like. But you know, I'm glad that the Bible speaks of another lion. Revelation chapter 5 and verse 5, the lion of the tribe of Judah. And I'm glad to read in the book of Hebrews, chapter 2, verse 14 and 15, that the lion of the tribe of Judah has destroyed him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, that we might not be all of our lifetime subject to bondage, that we might serve the Lord in freedom without any slavish fear of being destroyed by the devil. And then Peter is not through yet describing the devil. It doesn't sound to me like he believed that he is bound with a chain somewhere in some bottomless pit. But he said he walketh about. He's continually in motion. He never takes a rest. One time many years ago, I remember a man preaching a sermon on the fact that the devil takes no holidays. Well, that's right. He doesn't take a holiday. He doesn't take a sabbaticus. He doesn't take anything else. He's always busy. I'm afraid that shames the people of God sometime. Do you remember the description of the devil that we had back there in the book of Job in chapter 1 and verse 7? He appeared up there among the sons of God, the angels of God, and the Lord more or less asked him, said, what kind of dirty work you been into? Where you been? What you been doing? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Peter described him the same way, did he not? Then look in Job 2 and 2. And the Lord said unto Satan, from whence comest thou? And Satan, or the adversary, answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. So that's a very good description of the devil, that he walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. That's what he's like. That's a very good description of him. You know, if somebody came tonight and told us that a lion was loose somewhere out in our community, we'd be on the alert. If they told us now he's already eaten three or four fellows, and we think his appetite has rose up in him again, and he'll probably get anybody else he finds, we'd be vigilant, and we'd be sober-minded too, believe me. But you know, the devil in a sense is a lot worse than a lion that does no more than devours a body. The devil is able to devour man's body and soul. Therefore, he is to be feared more than any hungry lion that might escape from the zoo and might terrorize the countryside. Another time in the Bible, it's indicated that the devil doesn't take any holidays. He doesn't take any vacations. He's always busy. And remember that he sowed the tares among the wheat while the men slept. They were sleeping, but he wasn't asleep. He don't sleep. And then there's a statement there regarding a demon. Certainly true of the devil or the demon or any of his buddies and the like. In Matthew 12 and 43, when the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places. Note there how that the evil spirit is active, seeking rest and finding none. So he may seek it, but he never finds it. He's always busy doing the devil's work. And so the demons and the devil are pretty much alike. They never take any rest. They never go on a holiday. They never have any sabbaticus. They work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. God's people don't do that. That may be why we get defeated so many times. And then I want us to think for a few moments there about that statement, seeking whom he may devour. I was interested in that word, devour. It really, in the Greek, means to swallow down. If you don't think it has the meaning of swallow, another place it's used is in 1 Corinthians 15 and 54 when he said, death is swallowed up in victory. It's the same word over there. And I believe that it implies here ruin of the body and of the soul. Because, like I said, the devil can not only destroy man's body, he can also destroy his soul. Certainly not in the case of the child of God, but he can make the child of God pretty miserable in his body sometime too. And the devil is like a lion. He's out there to swallow people down. So don't get the idea that somehow he signed a peace treaty with God and somehow he's on vacation or going to a far country. Believe me, he is very active all the time. He never sleeps. He never rests. After all, he's a spirit. He doesn't need any rest because spirits never get tired. And I'll tell you what, there was one man that knew all about the devil, and that was a fellow that was writing this book. You remember the little encounter that he had with the devil? Let's go over there to Luke 22, and it'll certainly fit in with verse 9 that we're about to look at. Jesus said regarding Simon Peter, the man that's writing this book, now telling us to watch out for the devil. The Lord told Peter he better watch out for the devil. But you know, Peter didn't watch out very well. The old devil got him. Put him in the sifter. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you. He'd like to have every one of God's children. Well, now he can't send his soul to hell, no, but here's what he can do, that he may sift you as wheat. I know what it is to be sifted as wheat. You take all the bad particles out. In other words, the devil will show up all the bad things we got. He showed up that Peter could still curse even though he was an apostle. So Simon went into the devil's sifter. Years ago, I printed an article in the paper and got quite a few comments about it on Simon in the sifter. Right here it is. But you'll note that the Lord prayed for Peter, but I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. The only way that anybody can ever overcome the devil is by faith, and that's what Peter's going to bring out right here in the next verse. Peter's testimony failed, but evidently his faith didn't fail. He never at any time doubted the Lord. He just got scared for his own skin, I guess is the way to put it, and he began to lie and tell those things that were not true. But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. Then you come back over here to the 9th verse, and you find Peter telling us to do pretty much what the Lord told him to do over there. And Peter, too, is putting stress on faith, because Christ told Peter that what he needed to do was not to lose his faith, because the devil can't stand faith. That'll whip him every time. Now in verse 9, we're told that we are to stand up and oppose the devil. In other words, we're to go on the defensive. We're to defend our case against him. Now he's going around. He's not going to leave us alone. He's going to seek whom he may devour. And so he says, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. Whom resist? There's a personal pronoun used of the devil. That means he's a real person. I don't know how you'd resist a force or principle, but he's a real person. So no matter how or when he may attack you, you must fight manfully against him. You must be very courageous and do battle with him. James said pretty much the same in chapter 4 and verse 7. Said, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Funny thing is that Peter says that the devil, he comes and he attacks. James says, resist him, and said, you'll put him down the road, he'll be gone. And so you put them together there, and you see the attack, and then you see the defense, and then you see how that you defeat him. And it's by faith and by resisting him. You know, the Bible really only tells us to resist two things that I can think of. Now, if there's any other thing, maybe you can tell me about it sometime. We're certainly told here, and in James 4 and 7, to resist the devil. And we're told in Hebrews 12 and verse 4 to resist sin. Strive against sin. That means to resist it. Put up a fight against it. But you know, we're not ever told to resist the evil that men may do to us. And Jesus used that word resist, and he said not to resist evil that men would do to you. There in Matthew 5 and 39. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. So we are to resist sin. We are to resist the devil. But we are nowhere told to resist the evil that men may do to us. We are to trust providence in a time like that. Now, I believe the thought here in the mind of that Peter is bringing out here to many of these Hebrew Christians he's writing to, and no doubt a lot of Gentiles, is that God will help us to withstand the onslaughts of Satan. But you know, we're never told anywhere to go on the offensive against him. He's too big for us. All we can hope to do is defend ourselves. We're to resist him, but he does the attacking. We don't attack him. I've heard some people talking about how that the Christian ought to take a water pistol and charge hell and all of that. That's not a very good way to express what's set forth in the Bible. I've heard other people say, well, I give the devil a black eye. In fact, how can you give a spirit a black eye? That's a bunch of foolishness, really. I tell you what, the devil has given some of us black eyes, but I don't think we could really, strictly speaking, give him a black eye. So I say again, we're not told to go on the offensive, but we're always told to be on the defensive. We're to resist him when he attacks us. If there is anything that is bad for a Christian soldier, it's cowardice. It's a terrible, terrible thing when any soldier runs in the face of battle. During the time of the Civil War, they called him a yellow neck. They call him today a deserter. Some of them call him a traitor. They got all kinds of names for him sometime. But you know, cowardice will never win against the devil. It said, resist him and he'll flee from you. But if he fights against us and we flee, then we've lost. We're to stand our ground, you see. So cowardice will never win against the devil, only courage. What we need in the Christian warfare is not cowardice, but courage. And I believe that Christian soldiers fight best upon their knees when they pray for God's help. And so we are to fight the devil at all times and all places. We are always though to be on the defensive and never on the offensive. And then the next part of the verse not only says that we are to resist him, that's our first expression, then it said steadfast in faith. You know, it's remarkable that Peter had the Lord to pray for him that his faith fail not. Same thing he stresses here. The Greek word here for steadfastness is a military term. And it implies solidarity, rock-like firmness, meaning that our faith is to be in Christ, the rock on which the whole Christian life is built. So this term steadfast is an army term, and it speaks in the original of putting up a solid wall of defense that no enemy can penetrate. And what is that wall that he cannot penetrate? Faith. That's our wall of defense. Faith can help us to overcome the devil. There's one thing the devil cannot stand, and that's faith. You know, oftentimes the first thing that they try to corrupt in the mind of a young boy or girl when they go off to college, you know, these liberal professors and the like, they try to corrupt their faith. Because when they overturn the faith, they've overturned everything. And if the foundation be destroyed, how can the righteous stand, you see? But faith will overcome the devil. Nothing else will, but faith will. So we are to believe that God will give us the victory over the evil one. The word faith here is used in the sense of trustfulness and not in the sense of objective truth. Sometimes the word faith means doctrinal faith. Well, here it means practical faith, real trust in the Lord. Now, what is it that the devil attacks? He attacks our faith. He wants to get us to doubt. He wants us to question God. He wants us to wonder why. He wants to attack our faith. So to destroy faith in these Christians that Peter's writing to, he has raised up bitter persecutions against them. He set the very kings of the earth against them to persecute them. And that he's using to destroy their faith. You know, really strong trials will make faith stronger. They test our faith. They see what we're made out of. I can't help but think that maybe Peter had read Paul or something like that. Maybe he hadn't. Maybe I'm just surmising that in my own mind. But he certainly does remind me of what Paul wrote about the Christian warfare over there in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning at verse 11, when he said, "Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." Just another way of saying resist him, be on guard. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand therefore. Resist the devil, see. Stand up against it. Now, how are you going to do it, though? Having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. How are you going to stop the fiery darts? Above all, taking the shield of faith. How do you overcome the devil? By faith. Taking the shield of faith. Wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. So how are you going to whip the devil? With the shield of faith. He'll throw the fiery darts, throw up the shield, and it'll knock them off every time. But you know, if you let down that shield, those darts are going to get you. If you begin to lose some of your faith, and you begin to doubt and question God, then the devil's fiery darts will pierce you. It won't kill you, but they'll hurt you. They'll wound you. So faith is the only defense that we have against the devil. He goes on to talk about other things. The only offensive weapon we have there is the sword of the Spirit. And our shoes shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace and all of that. And then we come down to the very last statement here in our verse for tonight. And it seems like that it's put in there to encourage the people that Peter's writing to. When you first read it, you wonder, well, why did he tack that on to this watch out for the devil stuff? Because he said, knowing that the same afflictions that are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world, let me go back, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. I think that little word knowing is important because it means that the knowledge of the fact of this will lead us to cultivate the habit of considering it. If you know it, you'll think about it. So a consideration of other believers is a means of strengthening our own faith and qualifying us to resist the devil. You know, we're not the only ones the devil attacks. He attacks other Christians too. And so there's no strange thing come upon us. What is happening to us is a mere common experience of all believers. The devil is out to get us all if he can. He desires to have us all, like he did Peter. Paul, I think, used that term about the sufferings he endured to try to strengthen the faith of others and make them able to stand up against the devil. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 8 to 10, he said, we're troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We're perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. Always bearing about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our body. Then writing in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9 and 10, he said, as unknown, yet well known, as dying, and behold, we live, as chastened, and not killed, as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as poor, yet making many rich, and as having nothing, and yet possessing all things. So he pointed out the sufferings of other people, that he might encourage them to have faith and stand up against the devil. You know, the Christian brotherhood, and that's what he's talking about here when he talks about your brethren. Really, that's the same word in the Greek there that's translated elsewhere in this book, I believe in chapter 2, brotherhood. The Christian brotherhood is a brotherhood of suffering. The Christian brotherhood is a brotherhood of fighting the devil. Not each other, but the devil. And so at the time that Peter was writing this, a very fierce persecution against the Christians was being waged throughout the Roman Empire by the Roman Emperor. And so he's pointing out, you're not the only fellows that are suffering. Christians are suffering all over the empire at this time. So take courage in the fact that you're not alone. There are others in this same predicament. So don't give up in the fight. They're resisting. Why don't you resist? Well, we're told in 1 Corinthians 10 and 13 that there's no trial or temptation that comes upon us but what is common to man. And God will, with the trial or temptation, make us a way of escape. So trials and suffering are the common lot of the Christian. And you'll note how that it said, your brethren that are in the world. Jesus said in John 16 and 33, in the world ye shall have tribulation. Well, we're not in heaven tonight, we're in the world. And we're going to suffer. That's the common lot of believers in this world. You know, sometimes when I see other people bear up under their trials, it gives me more courage and faith. It really does. I remember years ago, I used to go to a rest home near Tupelo. And there was about 22 people there, and I'd go in the room and maybe read a verse, scripture to some of them, maybe say a prayer or something else whenever I could get over there, maybe once a week, sometime less, sometime more often. And I'd go over there to try to encourage them. But as I'd talked to many of those old saints, some of them laying there on the bed and couldn't even get up out of the bed, when I left there, I come away, I'd been revived. I hadn't revived them, they'd revived me. It went the other way. And so Peter seems to be saying here, you just remember that other people are suffering. They're bearing up. God's giving them grace to bear it. And if they can stand up and resist the devil, so can you. So don't fall by the wayside. So since others are able to bear up under their trials, so can we. And we're not alone in our suffering. It has always been the case with the heroes of faith. All you got to do is go read Hebrews chapter 11. And the very grace that sustained Peter, Paul, and Silas will sustain us, because God has not changed. One brother has said that he's enjoyed so much these lessons in Peter because he needed them. And knowing his situation, believe me, he's gone through some fiery trials. And so perhaps these lessons will not only be a blessing to him, but be a blessing to others. They certainly have been a blessing to me because I have needed the book if nobody else did. That's all of our lesson tonight. Let us stand and sing.